Welcome back to the program. Well, the American Revolution was primarily about political independence. There was a strain of individuals that wanted the United States to gain cultural and social differentiation from its former colonial masters, Great Britain. Today we're going to spend some time talking about the complexities of cutting loose from a nation that for two centuries had set the standard of civilization not only for the colonies, but for the world. In many ways, some of these issues of trade, of inferiority, of race, are still some of the issues that we're dealing with today, 300 plus years later. We're going to talk about it with my guest, Kerri-Ann Akimi-Yokota. She's an assistant professor of American Studies and History at Yale, as well as a fellow at the Huntington Library in Los Angeles. It is my pleasure to welcome Kerri-Ann here today to talk about her new book, Unbecoming British, How Revolutionary America Became a Post-Colonial Nation. Kerri-Ann Akimi-Yokota, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm really glad to be here and to talk with you and your listeners.
Great to have you here. It's interesting to look and see that this was a problem that even Jefferson was concerned about early on, the idea of America trying to achieve some kind of independent national identity from Great Britain.
Yeah, like you said in your opening, America was politically free after the Revolutionary War was won, but they found themselves still culturally, economically, and socially dependent on the mother country. And so what the book does is it explores this fascinating period in our nation's history in which we were kind of struggling between the promise of this glorious future as an independent nation and also struggling and grappling with what it meant to deal with your colonial legacy.
It was interesting how this evolved as an issue, because one of the things that was different, for example, from the French Revolution is that that was a revolution against culture. This was a revolution against politics, not necessarily against British culture.
Absolutely, and I'm so glad that you put it that way, because Americans really were at the height of Anglophilia culturally when the revolutionary movement broke out. So they were, in fact, becoming more and more like the mother country. And in a lot of ways, I think that explains why the revolution occurred. We were really fighting for our rights as Englishmen, after all.
And it was really only later that it became clear that there had to be, in order to kind of hold the nation together, there had to be things that America could be proud of. There had to be things that the country represented that could create a kind of collective pride.
You know, and the interesting thing that I found when I was researching this book is that one of the things that Americans early on felt proud of was their emulation of Great Britain. So that's a bit of an ironic twist. So one thing that created or always could be counted on to create pride was the fact that we were becoming more and more like the mother country. So they have a building in their town square. We have a building in their town square. They have a writer. We have a writer. So in that period, in this, like I said, this period of flux, emulation was not something to be embarrassed about, but in fact something to aspire to.
And yet, on the other hand, there was talk, although it didn't take hold very much, about creating a kind of American language.
Yes, I love that story. So I was researching this, and what I found was Americans at the beginning really did have some radical ideas about creating a separate national language. So people said, well, if France has the French language and England has English, then we should have our own. And so most famously, Webster is the one who says, well, let's, of the famous Noah Webster's dictionary, let's try to do something like with symbols, because if we're a democracy, we have to be efficient. You know, we don't need all of this fancy stuff. And so he had some ideas. Other people threw around some other systems. But when a European pointed out that, in fact, America does have a native language, as in the language of natives, as in Indians, American thinkers, Anglo-American thinkers, pretty much stopped their radical thinking and said, let's go back and try to reestablish our connection to the English language, because, after all, we have just as much right to famous British writers as they do, because we are part of this Anglophone world. And so what started off as a radical change turned into something very minor, like let's take the extra U out of labor,
right,
or color.
But part of it really was a reflection of this kind of ongoing conflict between wanting to be different on the one hand, wanting to be unique, but not wanting to lose that connection to British culture and history.
Yeah, and I think we have to remember how important the British Empire was in this period. And that, in fact, is why the American victory in the Revolution is so fantastic, is such a huge undertaking and a huge, I want to say, victory for these colonials, because Britain is really one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, political entity, and Americans were proud of that heritage and those links. But in the book, what I think is important is those links to European, what they thought was the European civility, and they mean Western European culture, really was important because of the existence of native peoples, of these other people of color in their midst. So not only Indians, but also Africans that they had imported for labor. So they're toiling in the midst of what they thought was the savage wilderness and with savage people around them. And so to differentiate themselves from the people on the ground, they had to recreate and continue to create new ties to the old world.
And in a way, it was a way to kind of import class struggle to America.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that's a great point. I feel that whenever you're studying American history, you have to be aware of the different perspectives in terms of class, race, and gender. And for Americans, what the people that I really focus on in this study are the elite Americans who were cosmopolitan, who really understood what was going on in Europe. And that's not to say that the importance of European culture did not trickle down to the lower classes, but I was interested in thinking about how the founding generation really had to struggle with feelings of inferiority, which was surprising to me, and it remains surprising to a lot of my readers, that those at the very top of America's colonial and then later post-colonial hierarchy really did feel like they were big players on a world stage.
But what it did in the long sort of historical arc is it provided the foundation for the degree to which America became a much more aspirational culture than Great Britain.
Yeah, you know, I think that's true. And another point that I make in the book is that what moving to America allowed people to do was to act like gentlemen and aristocrats, which that's sometimes surprising to us as well, because we think of America as being anti-aristocratic. But in fact, in England, for instance, hunting was reserved for the rich, those who own land. And, you know, poaching was a serious offense. So if you didn't own the land, you were not allowed to kill animals on anyone else's property. But you can come here to America, and any poor man can be a gentleman. So that was something that was a huge, I want to say a huge draw for many aspirational Europeans, and that's why they wanted to come here.
Talk a little bit about the areas where the inferiority was particularly pronounced. Medicine was one, the arts was another.
Yeah, so in the chapters that of my book, I look at different networks of transatlantic exchange. And so I look at the world of intellectuals. So medicine, in order to be a doctor of any standing here in the colonies, you had to actually go back to, and at that time, the University of Edinburgh in Scotland was the premier medical training institution in all of Europe. So Americans, even though they had a degree at, say, the University of Pennsylvania, which was one of the first medical colleges here, they said, well, if I want to be trusted by my patients, I need to go over there and be trained. So they had to go. Certainly, if you wanted to be involved in the arts or music, which was a hard thing in America in general, but if you wanted to really make a name for yourself, you had to go over there. So you see Americans well into the 19th century still taking that transatlantic voyage in order to refine themselves, quite literally, and then coming back and stepping into wonderful positions here in the States.
You talk about the University of Edinburgh. There was this interesting affinity, sort of a shared inferiority between the Americans and the Scots.
Oh, yes, I find that. I lived in Scotland myself, so I had a special interest in understanding this relationship between Americans and the Scots. And I think they did share an identity as being members of the British periphery or the English periphery. But what I found interesting was we tend to highlight the shared outsider status between the Scots and Americans. But when you read the Scottish records, what you see is that they felt that they were our masters, as in they were the colonial masters of America. And when Scotland and England signed the Act of Union in 1707, this allowed Scottish aspirational individuals to come and use English networks. And so you see Scots fanning out across the empire because they were the ones who were willing to leave home in order to make a name for themselves. So they were the ones who often were willing to come to America when high-ranking English people were not. So they were willing to come here and, again, to step into those positions of power.
Underlying all this was also an economic basis, in that trade was a big issue in terms of raw materials that were exported from the U.S. to Great Britain still, and also this sense that Great Britain at a certain point was kind of unloading its inferior goods to America.
Oh, yeah. So in the book, I talk about many a painful stories of our founding fathers feeling very disappointed, but not just disappointed that they got sent broken or out-of-date goods, but they took this really as a political and personal affront to the American nation, meaning if the British thought that they could unload these out-of-date goods on us, what must they think about our lack of knowledge or culture? So I make the point that looking at these these disappointments in America's purchases was not just something frivolous, but in fact, it really did reflect on our political stature.
What about ideas that were exported to Great Britain and then kind of made the round trip back to America in sort of a changed fashion?
Yeah, so I use the metaphor, which we mentioned earlier, the raw for the cooked,
right,
to talk about not only Americans who, for instance, they would procure beaver pelts from Native Americans on the frontier. They would send it back to Britain. It would be turned into felt and made into a gentleman's top hat or tricolor corner hat, depending on the period. And these hats were sold to Americans at a cost. And they were used to differentiate the white American settlers and the gentlemen from the rabble and from the people of color. So that's one way the raw was exchanged for the cooked and then sold back to Americans at a cost. But I think what you're talking about is also the fact that this was going on in intellectual circles. So Americans would trample through the backcountry, raiding nests. I talk about how they're climbing up trees, trying to steal birds' nests and pulling plants out by the roots, and stealing Indian graves, desecrating Indian graves to steal Indian skulls, sending it back to Europe, and then the European thinkers would turn these raw materials into theories about mankind and about mankind's degeneration in America. So there was this theory that Buffon had, he was a very prominent French thinker, that everything in the New World would degenerate. So it would become less healthy, these species would become sickly, smaller, and of course Americans took this personally because they are living in these raw environments. And so they spent a lot of time trying to refute these claims of inferiority physically. And so there was this one story of a dinner party in France that Franklin went to, and the Americans, it became a very heated discussion, and they said, "Hey, everybody stand up, let's see who's taller." And the Americans were taller than the French, and they said, "See, this proves our point," which is not scientifically proof. I don't know that scientists would believe that that was a good proof, but it was enough for Franklin, at least.
The thing that began to change all of this, that began to give America a greater sense of its own identity, was finally the migration westward. Talk about that.
Yeah, so when I give papers or lectures on this topic, one of the first things American audiences ask me is, so if we did feel inferior, when does it all end? And I think, oh dear, I think that question, maybe we have to think about that. But I say that as Americans move west and as the country matures culturally as well as politically and economically, we see a replication of these hierarchies of cultural civility and incivility moving instead of between the East Coast of America and England to members of the East Coast elite in Philadelphia and Boston and New York towards people, white settlers on the frontier. So you see the dynamics changing internally, and you hear people on the frontier saying that those snobs on the West East Coast are looking down at us. So I see that changing. But also, I think that Americans begin to really, they benefit economically from settlement, and also they develop internal trade networks. But the other thing is they start to embrace what makes us different. So my book really is trying to look at this period where they're not sure whether to move into something different, embrace nature, or whether they want to remain a country that's styled after their European precedents. So I think by moving west, we start to say, you know, let's embrace what makes us different. And let's really, art changes. So instead of emulating, for instance, British artistic trends, we start to see the Hudson River Valley School, which celebrates the glory of American nature and the scale and magnitude of the American landscape that Europeans have, you know, they could not compete at all on.
Are many of these things and the evolution of some of these things unique to the British and American experience, or is it your sense that there is something consistent about post-colonial regimes and their effort to establish their own identities?
You know, I think that's a really fascinating question, and I appreciate you bringing it up. I've thought a lot about it, and of course, for those who are familiar with post-colonial theory, post-colonial scholars are looking at very, very different forms, political forms. People who are in the 19th century, usually in Africa, Asia, and most famously, there's a lot of Indian scholars who talk about the break from the British Empire. What I wanted to investigate and what I end up arguing is that we cannot assume that because the American founding generation shared a racial or ethnic connection to the mother country that they did not experience these feelings of inferiority or insecurity. So I want to say just because they are, to use maybe a modern term and a very imprecise term, because they are white, they didn't feel inferior. I'm saying that they did, in fact. So I think that the idea of a colony, or we have to understand that for a colony to change into a nation, it's a process. It's not something that is bestowed upon you because you sign a peace treaty. And that culture and cultural inferiority in all of these different places and different times, like in the late 19th century, it's the cultural inferiority that continues to be a problem for newly emerging nations.
I was going to say it's a very personal kind of thing. It's not dissimilar from the child outshining the parent at some point.
Yes, absolutely. And if you want to push that familial metaphor, Americans really are these teens in the 19th century. So you had mentioned, okay, so when they move west, they break from the British. And I would say yes and no. Just like a teenager who wants to assert their independence, it's always against the parents. So you know that the parents still play a great a great part in a teenager's life when you're always thinking about rebelling against. So, for instance, Americans just cannot start being on their own. They always have to say, unlike Britain, we are a wild people. We are free. We do this, not like them. So they're always measuring themselves against the British. And I wouldn't say that is complete independence. I would say you're still lockstep in this, what I call a post-colonial dance.
Right. And of course, we've gone through other more contemporary periods of cultural cross-pollination, the 60s being perhaps the penultimate, and even to some degree today with things as silly as reality television.
Oh, it's, yeah, I know. Whenever I see my students love reality television, they said, guess what? It's like a BBC production. I said, yeah, exactly. And also talking about popular culture, my friends in England always say to me that we in America enjoy the royals much more than they do. So this madness of about, and madness not as in being angry, but the crazy love of the royal wedding that we just experienced again with Prince William and Kate. And I said, well, we enjoy it because we get to enjoy the spectacle without paying the bills.
Carrie Ann Akemi Yokota, her book is Unbecoming British, How Revolutionary America Became a Post-Colonial Nation. It's just out from Oxford University Press. Carrie Ann, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was very enjoyable.
Thank you.